Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 23, delivered on November 13, 2018. The title of this lecture is Capital Budgeting.
Today, capital budgeting. Before we go to the capital budgeting lecture, I'll show you some numbers for the day's markets. And also on Thursday, bring a computer or your TI-8384 calculator, because we'll be doing some of this there too. You'll be surprised at how easy this subject is when you've got a calculator or a computer. But for the markets for the day, something of a mixed day. Really, let's turn on the projector here overhead. Mixed day. You can see that the Standard & Poor's 500 was down 0.15%, which isn't anything significant. It's just down a little bit. The Dow was down a little bit more noticeably, nothing spectacular. And then the NASDAQ was pretty much flat for the day. I mean, dead flat almost. This is a quiet day, all things considered, which tends to kind of worry some of us, because in the past, after a high volatility series of sessions in the market, there's been a tendency for the market to go quiet. And then all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose and you've got the maelstrom. The downstroke. Is that what's happening here? Probably not yet, but we've got to be prepared for something that's going to be a fairly strong downstroke here within the next couple of weeks. Although I don't know if that's going to be the full crash yet, but it's coming. I'm not even going to try this. Now, on to the subject at hand, which is capital budgeting. You write down, I'll show you the keystrokes on your calculator, and make a few mentions along the way about some old methods that are still rather surprisingly popular in use, and they're bad methods too. And mention that one of the things that we're doing in educating the new business professionals like you is to try to get more people in to sweep away those old bad methods. But they still show up from time to time in the business. At the end of the day, in decision making in a business, we are not going to engage in deep, long-term philosophical discussions. Everything in a business decision making environment has to do with yes or no. We do this or we don't do it. We choose this path or this path. We have a point in time, ideally fairly quickly, but sometimes it takes a little longer, where we stop discussing and we say yes or no. And once we've made that decision, that's when the crying stops. No, we're not going to do this project. But no, that's the end of the discussion. Or yes, we are going to do this project. In retrospect, it turned out not to be a very good project. And that's where we say we did the best practices. We followed the book. We did it by the rules. That's how we do the CYA. You know what CYA means, don't you? Cover your ass. Yeah, CYA means cover your ass. Because you see, at the end of the day, if something goes sideways, you're going to have people like this son of a bitch who are going to say, "See, I told you that didn't work." Yeah, and you know what you're going to say? "See, I did it by the way it's supposed to be done. That's best practices." Now, if you don't like that, well, you can KMA. You know what that means. Okay, I just want to make sure. What I'm trying to get at here is that we have decision-making rules in business. We are not creative in that sense. You want to be creative? Well, go do some art. But in the world of business, we don't have that luxury of the creative mind. And these people say, well, I like to think out of the box. Well, that's because the box is full of rocks who are smarter than you are, son. You're probably going to think out of the box. You're going to reinvent half what's in the box, and what you didn't reinvent is crap anyway. Don't get into that imagination. We say that. We think out of the box. We care about creativity in our business. No, you don't. I've been in your corporate world. You're a bunch of conservatives, just like me. We aren't fighter pilots. You know what happens to fighter pilots? They get shot down. Okay. Understand that when I'm teaching you these rules, these are rock solid rules. You do it this way and you make a decision. Is it right or wrong? Well, time will tell on that. And sometimes we have to rewrite the story of the history of our company or the history of a decision making to make sure that it comes out making us look smelling like roses. Back to bad practices, though. Years and years ago, I was in these kinds of classes like you're in right now, and I learned, well, you do this, you don't do this. This is old style stuff. We shouldn't do this anymore. And so I went out there into the consulting world and running business, and I ran into so many companies that were doing things that were explicitly not best practices. And we were going to see one of those right tonight. And there was a time when I wondered, why textbooks like yours that you have for this course, why they still even mention these bad practices? They're very clear, this is bad. But they say, well, here it is. Well, why would you even mention it? Well, the problem is that, just like I found out, many companies are still using these bad practices for decision making. And in one case, the first one I'm going to show you, I saw a study done about 2 years ago, which did not surprise me at all, that of the methods available for capital budget decision making, this method was still the most popular of all the methods, even though it is absolutely wrong to use it. So as time goes on, we bring you out there, we will slowly begin to shake off that world of these old fossilized methods that really aren't appropriate to use. You'll see. It's very it's blinking obvious. But even with well-educated people, if they have a mindset or if they've been doing something for long enough, they are not going to change. And they are going to be completely resistant to reason and logic and all of the citations and books that you could show to them. I have a brother. He's 72 years old. He keeps saying email's a fad. I just write letters. Well, I can't read your writing anymore, you fool. Well, this email, you know, that's going to go away. This internet thing, I don't even know what it is. But I've lived long enough to know that's just a fad. Okay, bro. But you're going to run into that out there, and you'll see why you should not use this. Consider this. Let's say that you have a project that, okay, year cash flow. Year 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. And I'm going to say a few things along the way here. In year 0, you're going to push out the door, let's say $20,000. In year 1, the project will generate the first revenue, $5,000. In year 2, it will begin to pick up speed as the product begins to get an audience. And then by year 3, you've got year 1, 5,000, year 2, 12,000. At year 3, you're up to 20,000. Oh, I'm sorry. At year 3, you're up to, let's say, no, it's beginning to slide off 8,000. In year four, you're at $1,000.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, let me switch this around. At year two, you've got your 8,000, and at year three, you've got your 12,000. Now, the first method I will teach you. Now, by the way, capital budgeting has to do with what we accept and what we reject as projects. What we accept and what we reject as projects. And it boils down to that exactly. Accept or reject, yes or no. There's no in-between in business. Don't get nuanced. If you want to be nuanced and be philosophical, well, we can go out for drinks later and do that kind of stuff. But in the business world, we have to say yes or no, accept or reject. Now, the first method is the one that should not be used. It was used for centuries before we understood really fully why you should not use it. But it works like this, and I've seen it so many times in business. We accept only those projects that pay for themselves within 3 years. This is called the payback method. The payback method. And for this company, it has a policy of its payback period policy is 3 years. So, this project came in at $5,000 on year one, so there's $5,000. At year two, 8,000 more, so we're at 13,000. And year three, we are 12,000 more, so that's 25,000. And at year four, we have another 1,000, that's 26,000. Okay. So the payback period on this project is within the 3 years, because at year three, it has paid for itself. So we accept this project. Now, here's what's wrong with it. See that 5,000 and that 8,000, 12,000, that 1,000, they are not the same as each other in terms of value. $8,000 in 2 years is not comparable to $5,000 in 1 year. $5,000 in 1 year is not comparable to $20,000 out the door in year zero. We have not taken into account the time value of money, the erosion of value. This $12,000 here in year three, depending on the discount rate, that's actually worth maybe $10,000, $9,000, or $8,000 today. And we're trying to compare this to a today expenditure of $20,000. So the payback method does not take into account the loss of value with time that money realizes. That's its big problem. But there's an even bigger problem under the surface. And this problem actually invades one of the acceptable methods sometimes too, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But the other big problem here is this. 3 years. I gave up. I said, well, there was a company I consulted for down in Houston. The CEO, he was an old guy at the time, he said, well, our payback period is 5 years. And I asked, well, where did 5 years come from? That's what it's always been. Okay, why? Why five? That's just how we do it. If you don't like that, then you can find consulting somewhere else. essentially, there was no rational reason for a five-year payback. It was just like, here it is, it's always been this way, and so we're going to always have it that way from now on. Well, you know, guys live until about the age of 40. That's the way it always was, so when you're 41, we're going to kill you, kind of thing. We stick to the old methods, the old ways. That's just not going to work. More, and even beyond that, too, what this does is that when you set a payback period, you are, in a sense, ultimately deciding not to fight for the long haul. Because at some point, you're going to run into projects where their payoffs are, the big money is way down the road from the initial phases of the company. Think about that in your experience now, where we are now 20 years out easily from mining asteroids. But we have got to start doing the work now. The payback periods are going to be up. I mean, you'd have to set payback periods of 50 years to see these as acceptable, and yet we know damn well we've got to do it. It's like space entertainment, hotels, restaurants, and all that kind of stuff in near-Earth orbit. We've got to do it. It's going to take another 15 years before we'll actually have any, we'll be bending metal in the sky. But at the same time, we've got to start doing the planning now and say, screw payback period. It's going to take forever for us to actually get this thing done. Like I said, we won't bend metal in the sky until 15 years out on these things. But we got to do it now. So pulling a payback period out of your butt is just not going to be a good idea. And like I said, you're going to see a variation on that in one of the best practices methods here in just a little bit. But put this one off to the side. I also want to make another point. If you see a project having a salvage value at the end of its life, put that salvage value in with the last year's cash flow. Like if this project had a salvage value of $200, you put that money in there at the back end of the project, at the end. Now, sometimes that will be actually a positive number. Sometimes it could be a negative number. But you gotta talk about the end of a project. At the end of a project, you're going to have equipment that can be sold. You're also, on the other side, going to have things like closing down a facility. More often than not, you're going to have environmental remediation done. Well, we didn't do anything hazardous. Well, yeah, you did. You probably didn't know it. But even if you had computers in there, that's hazardous waste. You're going to have to pay to remediate, to get that out of the site. You're also going to have other kinds of costs that are involved in closing down projects. So you're going to have costs, and you're going to have unusual revenues there at the end. That creates a composite value that you call salvage value. You put that in with the last year's sales to get the final picture at the end of the project's life. It's also another odd thing that's going to happen at the end of a project's life, too, is that if it's something like a retail project, at the beginning of a project's life, you have this bloody cash outflow of building inventory. It actually is a negative cash flow, getting the inventory into the shops. And then that will probably stay stable over the life of the project. You'll sell, you'll buy, you'll sell, you'll buy. So it stays flat. But at the end year of the project, there is one last cash punch where you sell off the last of your inventory. So that has to show up there too in that terminal year's salvage value is what I call it. So keep that in mind that there are these things at the end of a project. So if you just see, if you're analyzing some project, well, you know, that might be not looking at what happens at the end of a project. There's good and there's bad. Well, but also keep in mind that there are many places. I think I already told you about this. Did I tell you about the room downstairs that none of you have ever seen? Did I ever tell you about it? Oh, no. All of you could go in there, but it's haunted.
No, we'll go with
no. Okay. We'll go down there sometime, all of us will. Yeah, I've got that ghost hunting club. It's actually a very interesting place down there. Voices. But but in this room. They're actually going to open it up and turn it into computer labs and maybe classrooms. I don't know what their final plan was, but there's a room down there, and right now it has stuff in it. Now, you might think, what do you mean by stuff? But when I hear stuff, that means, oh, cool. That's like an attic or a garage or an old barn. There's cool stuff down there. And in that room are computers from an era long before you were born. When computers were replaced, and this is true in many companies over the years, they will just put the old computers in a warehouse or in a basement, and they'll just leave them there forever and ever. Now, down there are computers with big monitors, you know, the kind back in my time, 4-inch wide monitors. Oh, those were awesome. You know, you're looking like they have floppy disks down there, these giant things that go and you poof, poof. Into a computer, and they held, oh, it was awesome. There were some of those that held almost a whole megabyte of data, a whole megabyte of data. Seriously, it was, and then there are a couple of hard drives down there. At the time, they cost maybe about $8,000, $10,000. They held 10 megabytes of data, 10 megabytes. I mean, we're talking awesome technology. But at the time, they were set aside. They were not horribly outdated. They could have been sold for value. Hell, we could have even donated them for tax benefits to charities or to schools. There were schools that would have died at that time, back in the 80s, to have computers for kids. That would have been awesome. They wouldn't have cared if they were a little outdated, but instead, we and many, many companies, universities, institutions, they just put things away and close the doors, clock, clock, and lock them. And the only time we unlocked them was when we put a dead body in there that we didn't want, you know, complicated, you know, when, you know, students, you know, anyway. Okay, awkward. So watch out, beware the company that says, well, we don't have any salvage value. You didn't have anything that could be sold. You didn't have anything that cost money to close down. Nope. And at that point, you say, bullshit, and move on. This is a larger problem, too. But let's get away from this. Now I'm going to just take you to how we do it. And I'm going to remind you that before we had these little computers we call calculators, financial calculators, and before we had the spreadsheets and back before your time, these were done by hand, either mathematically or with tables like the ones that you saw in your accounting classes. And either way you cut it, it was a lot like work. In one case, I'm going to show you a problem that takes maybe about, 15 seconds to enter the data. It takes the calculator less than a second to make the calculation. That when I was in a class like this, it would have taken about 3 to 5 hours, depending on how good you were at doing math real fast. And I was not good at doing math real fast. So it took me quite a long time until I learned how to cheat off the Japanese kid that sat next to me. No, I didn't say that.
Edit that out of this podcast.
It was okay with him. I told him I was admiring his shoes. Where the hell was I? Okay. First things first, we will need a discount rate. In other words, we have got to discount cash flows back to now in order to find the present value of $5,000, the present value of $8,000, the present value of $12,000, whatever. Okay, so what we're going to do here is, for the time being, now this is where what I showed you last week comes in. What discount rate do we use? Well, we probably are going to try to use the capital asset pricing model to get an R sub S for a project. If that fails, we've got we could try using the weighted average cost of capital, the WACC. We've got to find some way to get a discount rate. And we can do that. Best practices, Try to use CAPM. If you can't use that, then use the weighted average cost of capital or something, maybe even a weighted average of the two. But anyway, let's say the discount rate, we're going to discount these cash flows back. Let's try 5%, okay? And we're going to calculate what's something called the net present value. We are going to find the present value of $5,000 1 year out, plus the present value of $8,000 2 years out, plus the present value of $12,000 3 years out, plus the present value of $1,000 4 years out, and then we're going to subtract the initial amount, $20,000, and see if we get a positive or negative number. Okay, so now doing this, you bring up your calculator, and I'll do this on Thursday with Excel, too. But we'll do plenty of these, so don't sweat. Apps. Finance. Now, this time, go down to 7, or just key in 7. That's the net present value, NPV. Enter. Now, you come back to the main screen, you got NPV. The first thing that you're going to want to do is key in 5. Don't key in 0.05, 5, okay? Now, with the TI calculator, a comma flags that you have ended a piece of information and something else is about to happen. So you're going to put in a comma, and the next thing you're going to do is put in your initial cash outflow, negative, and don't put a minus sign, put negative. Whoops. I know, two negatives make a positive. $20,000. Now you're finished with that, so you're going to put in a comma again. Now here's where you have to watch it. You're going to announce, here comes cash flow, positive cash flow. A TI wants that in braces, not parentheses, in braces. Second parenthesis opens braces. Don't use parenthesis or you will get an error. For the positive cash flows, which you're now going to key in. So the next thing you're going to do is now give it the positive cash flows, which were 8,000. Comma. 5,000 was it? Wait, 5,000 then 8,000. Okay, easy enough to fix. Oh, God, yeah, because the calculator is seeing the order as representing the year. Comma. 5,000, comma. What was it, 8,000? Comma. 12,000. Comma, 1,000. Now, you're going to close the brace because that tells the TI, I'm finished with positive cash flows. So second, close parenthesis, which makes the close brace. And now close the parenthesis that initialized the function's inputs. And then you hit enter. And the project has a $3,206.89 present value. We accept the project. If it's a positive number, doesn't matter how positive. We accept. If it's a negative number, we reject. That's as simple as it is. If it's positive, we accept. If it's negative, we reject. Yes? This is best practices. This is the very best practices, is the net present value method. You've got all kinds of twists. There's another one which is very popular that's also best practices until it's used improperly. This one, the calculation itself is not improper, and you'll get an answer. It will be a yes or a no answer. The other method I'm going to show you that's popular and accepted has some very serious warnings that I have to attach to it. But for this one, the answer is yes. Yeah. It's one of the two best practices methods. And it's called the net present value method, the NPV method. Yeah. Yeah, I just pulled that out of my ass for this one. Yeah. Yeah, basic. Yeah, go ahead.
So this is a buy, this is a yes, this is
accept
this project.
Accept this project.
Is anything over zero?
Anything? A zero, you are indifferent. Yes or no? It's meh.
Like, we're not going to make any money, but I guess we'll be doing it.
You will not make any unusual money. A zero would mean that you'll make exactly the economic profit of zero on the project. But that doesn't mean it doesn't suck. In a competitive market, you should be shocked if you find too many positive NPV projects. Quite honestly, if everything that comes to you has a positive NPV, you say, hold up, something is wrong here. Because you should not find all that many positive NPV projects. And that's so get suspicious. And we're going to talk about that here in a minute. I want to show you something interesting here. I'm going to go back and I'm going to say, okay, what if I was wrong and the discount rate was supposed to have been 8%? Well, first, let me show you how you can edit a formula, which I've shown you before and I'll show you again. If I hit second enter, what I entered will come up again, except now I can edit it. I'm going to go back up here and I'm going to key in, put the cursor over the 5. Now, if I just type in 8, it will overwrite the 5. If I want to put the 8 beside the 5, I'd have to put second insert. Okay, if all I want to do is overwrite a number, I just put the cursor over the number and key in the number I want. If I want to actually insert beside a number, then I would have to say second insert, which is the key above DEL, delete, to get that to happen. It will naturally just overwrite. Now I've put in 8%. Let's see what happens. It's still positive NPV at 8%. It's $1,749.36. So now let me try one more time. Yeah.
So is this like theoretically a bond? That's why there's a discount rate?
Well, a bond is like this because a bond is a net present value. At par, it would have an NPV of zero. Oh, that's like I said, capital asset pricing model. I'm going to find some way to get a discount rate. What's the beta of this project? If that doesn't work, then I'm going to go to my component cost of capital and build the weighted average cost of capital and use that. Something, I need a discount rate. It's got to be something other. In the real world, I'm not going to pull it out of my butt. I'm going to use a best practices for getting a discount rate. Typically, that's the, I would use, the CAPM to do it. That's really cumbersome if you don't have the beta of a project. So the next one would probably be to try to use a weighted average cost of capital, which isn't the best idea in the world, but you know, when you're desperate for a discount rate, you'll grab what you can. Now let me go here one more time. Let me try a discount rate of 12%. So I'm going to edit the formula again, and this time you'll see me do two things. Second, enter. And now I'm going to go up here, and the first thing I'm going to do is put the cursor over the 8 and key in 1. That will overwrite the 8. And then I'm going to hit second insert and key in a 2, which will slip a 2 in beside the 1. So that I did this on purpose so you could see using the overwrite and then using an overwrite with an insert. And now I'm going to say, let's rock and roll again, enter. Oh, even at 12%, this little son of a dog. $18.72. Huh? You'd say, meh. It's economically, you are making a profit of exactly zero. Accounting-wise, you would probably be making a positive profit. Because remember, economic profit is going to be less than accounting profit. So if it's making a zero economic profit, your accountants are probably going to get all kinds of gooey and giddy. Ooh, this one's going to make us money. Well, yeah. I mean, that's what accountants are for.
Right. So, I mean, zeros would therefore almost always be.
I'm going to probably see, look, in a competitive market, anything that can make unusual economic profit, you would be surprised if there are a lot of those that haven't already been found. But they are out there. There's always opportunity. But don't just think, oh, just because, I mean, everything comes up roses for me. Be suspicious of people like that. Be suspicious of companies like that. Be suspicious of people. Oh, everything I advise on comes out to be true. Well, I'm a psychic, or I see ghosts everywhere, or I see visions of the future. No, you're just a weird-ass person. Maybe once or twice in your life you're going to see a ghost. Keep getting positive NPV projects. Yeah. Let's try 14%. I'm going to beat this sucker down. I am going to beat this sucker down. Okay, one more time. Second, enter. And we're going to put a four in for the percentage. Ah, finally. Reject the project. -$766.56. So if my discount rate were 14% on this project, I would say no. If it were 12%, I'd say yes. Now, here's the important thing about this, and then I'm going to go back and talk a little more. Okay. On the vertical axis, I'm going to show net present values. And on the horizontal axis, I'm going to show discount rates. Five percent, 6, 7, 9, 10%. 12, 13, 14, 15%, 16%. Okay, so now at 5% discount rate, this project had a net present value well up here of $3,200 or so. At a discount rate of 8%, the project still had NPV positive, $1,750. That would be right about there. At 12%, it still was just slightly positive, 12%, and then at 14%, it was negative. This thing right here, this line you see happening, that is a net present value function line. It should be fairly linear. At least it should be anyway. An NPV line. At low discount rates, NPVs are positive. Now, and at high discount rates, they're negative. Now, every project will have its own characteristic line in terms of slope, the scale that you use, and all of that kind of stuff, regular math stuff. But that is what it looks like. Special place on the line. Notice that at any discount rate below this crossing point right here, we accept. At any point above, we reject the project. The crossing point where the discount rate that makes the net present value zero, the discount rate that makes the net present value zero is called the internal rate of return. The IRR. Yeah. No, go ahead. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. Go ahead. Once. Unless you've done a new capital expenditure, leave it alone. Okay. No, seriously. I want you to think about this. Okay. Your beloved Aunt Mabel has died. That was in the year 1993. Now, how often do you go to Aunt Mabel's grave and check to see if she's still dead? I don't. You know why? Because if she isn't, then I'm going to really freak out. Ah! Okay, leave Aunt Mabel alone. However, if there is new capital expenditures that are unexpected that must be made, then you do a new project using those new expenditures as the initial cash flow and the money that you'll make out of it as the positive cash flow out in the out years. But if a project is just sitting there, leave the stupid thing alone, okay? Do you really want to see Aunt Mabel after she's been cooking for 25 years in the grave? No. She wasn't all that great looking when she was alive. Especially in that paisley dress she bought from JCPenney catalog. But anyway. Here's the thing. Now, going back. Now, the internal rate of return is a best practices method. But in itself, it's not a method. It's just there. It's a definitional point. It's a fulcrum between yes and no for NPV analysis. Before I go any further, though, beware the project creators who have a vested interest in getting you to say yes. You cannot be on one side or the other. You can be on my side. No creativity whatsoever. I'm just an old bitch. I'll say no. Or you can be the creators. You suffered, you struggled to get this project, the ideas, the flow of energy in your team that made this idea come to life and get the cash flows working. You can be one or the other, but you can't be both. Don't try. So on my side, I'm going to look at the cash flows, and the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to ask, are those real? Are those realistic? Because you are going to figure out fairly quickly that the bigger you make those numbers, the less likely it is that my analysis will say no. The lower you try to get me to have the discount rate, the more likely I'll say yes. You're going to do everything you can to get a yes, and I'm going to do everything I can to find out if you are bluffing me or not. You think this doesn't happen? It happens all the time. Most of the disasters in business come because of overinflated expectations. Well, we did focus groups, and they did. No, you didn't. You did groups that you chose just because they were going to say, we love your product at this high price point. And you probably gave them the product free for them to try it out, fool. Or you're going to do even worse than that. You're just going to out and out live in a fantasy world about the cash flow sizes. The project, and I'm almost sure I told you about it already. Maybe I didn't, but I will repeat it just to make sure that it's emphasized. Downtown Bloomington is a happening place. You know that, right? It's a bunch of rednecks drinking beer and staggering around at night trying to get into my art gallery and rampage in there and belch on my photographs and my art. Irritates me. Well, many years back, almost before your time, there was a mayor of the city of Bloomington, and she had a vision for a sports arena. Not just a sports arena, but for an arena that would have a sports team playing in it. It would have, be a venue for the greatest performers of the era in there. Hell, it was going to put Bloomington, Illinois on the map. And this was going to be her legacy. And she had some of the fathers of the town, the bankers in town, and the movers and shakers on her side. And she wanted to stir up all the interest so that we would build this beautiful arena here in town. And so in her nightly and daily efforts to drum up the support, she wanted to speak to the students at a private college that I was teaching at here in town at the time. It was an odd setup for this course because it was actually three courses, marketing, finance, and management, all combined into a single course where the different professors would teach on different days. Weird ass, it didn't work. They finally gave up on it, mostly because they said I screwed it up. But anyway, so we were to bring all of those business students into a big auditorium like this one over at the university that night so that she could come in and pitch this sports arena and tell the business students about the decision-making process that tells us this is the greatest idea in the world. She brought along with her her finance guy, scrawny, weaselly little young man. She had a collar on him. Come, boy, come sit. And she talked all about how great this place was. And then for the business, you know, she wanted to make sure we saw the numbers that this, there were numbers, so which means it really has to be legitimate because these are numbers. She had her lackey come up there and start showing all the numbers. Well, at every stage, he's saying, are there any questions? And, of course, these kids aren't going to ask any questions. They're total prep. They're there looking in their best clothes, looking really perfect, nice, upstanding. And then, of course, they'd go home and get wasted and then pretend that they didn't for the professors and parents. But that was another story entirely. And so finally, I began to pick on the poor son of a bitch who was up there. The first thing was, of course, the thing I'm almost sure I told you. I was looking at his costs, and there was no cost for land to build the sports arena. Why isn't there any cost for the land? Oh, because we own it. You own it. Oh, so you've never heard of opportunity cost. The cost of what you could have done with the land if you hadn't done this stupid thing to it. There are all these costs that were ignored, completely ignored in the budgeting. Then came the unbelievable part. the revenues. The first problem was, the first amazing, just amazing, was that they projected ticket sales on a 60-mile radius around Bloomington, Illinois. Around Bloomington, Illinois. Okay? Of course, what's within 60 miles of Bloomington?
Peoria.
Yeah. You know what else is within 60 miles? If you take out the Peoria Peoria Civic Center, you know what else is within 60 miles of Bloomington? Cows, corn, things like that. Nothing whatsoever. So you're not going to get insane revenues. Yeah, Ma and Pa Kettle. Yeah, I think we should go into Bloomington tonight because Snoop Dogg is playing down there. I've always been really good with his music. I hear he's got some real cornrows, and I've been trying to get the corn straight, and he's supposed to do that, I guess. That's what he's about. Yeah, sure. It ain't going to happen. It was a fantasy. Inflated numbers, inflated egos, and, of course, just like so many cities across the United States, the starry-eyed fools bought the thing hook, line, and sinker. And now, does anyone know what color the financial statements are of the Bloomington Arena? Red. They are so red. I mean, the traffic lights aren't that red. Blood isn't that red. I mean, the redshift of the galaxies on the end of the universe aren't that red. These things are so red that, I mean, you don't wear underwear that red, okay? I'd speculate, bro. Okay. I know, but that's a shirt, man. That's a shirt. Shirts are okay. I know, shirts are just shirts. The bottom line here is this, that the inflation of those numbers is classic. Now, it will come, finally, it's coming to these idiots. We're going to have to sell this arena to a private interest. Those were the same private interests who were there to get this thing started. All they do is they just set these suckers up and sit back 10 years and wait. And then they can buy these giant sports arenas for pennies, literally pennies on the dollar, and rock and roll into the future. Go. Yeah, that one. You make a place out in the cornfields. You're going to have cornfield people managing it. You're going to have cornfield people going to the venue. You're not going to get a giant team in there. You're not going to get real professional finance people. You're going to get local hoe handle. Hey, there's an extra $200,000 there. Anyone know where that belongs? Well, let's just split that among ourselves. You're going to get that kind of mentality. Of course you will. We were not in a position, maturity-wise, to be able to do it right and to do it without inflating the numbers and to do it without egos. Go.
There are already two large stadiums right nearby that do the exact same
thing. I know. It just kills me. And I tried, you know, but at the time, of course, you know, I was a bad person for embarrassing these people with, you know, financial analysis for a real financial analyst who does this for a living, who's done it in places very much. I mean, the suckerhood is just amazing. And you say, well, that can't happen all the time. Oh, it does. I mean, there are banks in this town that have to be audited all the time because these guys from Chicago come down and they wine and dine these fools and get them to start putting bank money into projects in Chicago, which are completely ludicrous. They ain't going to happen. And then the banks are going to get creamed, and then they're going to have to be taken over by the federal government, and, you know, the people are going to have to be paid off by the FDIC for their insurance, for their deposits. And it happens all the time. The suckers are out there. And if you think free markets are great, yeah, until you figure out that almost everyone in the universe besides you is a damn fool, and you're not so good on most days either.
It just sounds like living in this state.
What? Okay.
So
No. Look. I come from an era when we had respect. We had Al Capone. We had Pretty Boy Floyd. We had the Untouchables. We had real people with real goals and values. God. Yeah, have you ever noticed there's a linear relationship between pity and fools? It's positive. The first derivative of pity fool is positive. No, seriously, think about it. Okay, here is fool. Here's pity on the y-axis. Here's fool. The greater the fool, the more the pity. That's a positive line. That's a positive first derivative on the Mr. T equation. But it's still positive. Okay, even if it's like this. Even if it's like that, that's still first derivative positive, second derivative negative. Do not mess with me with calculus, brah. Okay, this kind of class is getting out of hand. Yeah, go ahead. Fire away. I should not hope so, no. I can just see how that would play out on my professor. You know, he had his pity fools. Now, here's an interesting thing about the internal rate of return, though. A very useful thing you can do with internal rate of return is this. Suppose, sir, that you are my budget yes or no man, okay? So you're wearing a tie, so you're obviously, and that's a good tie, you know, really good. The tie class, it's coming back in. Do you have a pocket on it? Do you have a pocket on your shirt? Good. Supposedly that's not in style now. I mean, I brought in this expert on dressing for my students 2 years ago, and he's just standing there, and one of the kids said, should you have a pocket in your shirt or not? And, of course, he said, no, that's just old guys who do that. Everyone looks at me, really? Anyway, where the hell was it? Oh, okay. I give you the cash flows, the negative and the positives. And I say, I'll get to the discount rate for you tomorrow, okay? Well, you could say, well, I'll just sit here and wait. Or you could do the internal rate of return. Let's say that you do the internal rate of return, and it comes out to be 7.8%. Well, tomorrow I go to you, and I say, well, the discount rate I want you to use is 6%. You don't even have to do the NPV. You can just say accept. Because you see, you know that if 7.8% is the crossing point, 6% was below it. It's a positive NPV project. Once you got the internal rate of return, you can just say the yeses and nos at the different discount rates for the project. That's one use. Now, there is a dark use of it. Now, on Thursday, I'm going to tell you a couple of places where you cannot use the internal rate of return, at least not without modifying it severely. On this chart here, the problem is that when companies do hurdle rates, a hurdle rate is a company-directed rate of return that all projects must meet or exceed. The hurdle rate is a rate of return that all projects accepted by the company must meet or exceed. So in this case, I'm giving you a hurdle rate. A company has a hurdle rate. All projects must meet this hurdle rate of 10%. So, we have four projects on the table. Here's your hurdle rate right here at 10%. Project A has an internal rate of return of 9.4%. So, in other words, Project A is crossing the x-axis, the discount rate axis, at 9.4%. You see that you reject that project? Because at 10%, it's a negative net present value project. So we reject Project A. Project B has a 12.8% internal rate of return. So that means that project crosses the x-axis, the discount rate axis, up here at 12.8%. So this project would be positive at the hurdle rate. So we say yes. Project C has a 7.3%. This thing doesn't even have a chance. It crosses the x-axis way down here at 7.3%. So at 10%, this project is a no, because it's way negative by the time it gets to 10%. You put 10% in for the cash flows of Project C, it's going to be a very negative number. However, for Project D, that's a 15% internal rate of return, so it crosses the x-axis, the discount rate axis, clear up here at 15%. So that one is going to be a yes. Hurdle rate is very common, very popular. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, that study that was done, internal rate of return and hurdle rate used together, is the most popular. Here's its first big problem. Where the hell is the 10% coming from? Why 10%? I have actually asked that of CFOs who've been using this. And they say, well, we've always used 10%. I don't know when we started, but we always use it. That's how it is. You can't do that, for one thing, because interest rate environments change. So 10% in one economic time frame would not mean the same thing as 10% in another economic time frame. The other thing is that this is the nasty, the darkest side of this, is that it is a backdoor way of shaping the risk policy of the company. Because, of course, the higher you set that hurdle rate, the riskier the projects will be that you accept. And, in other words, you're going to turn down projects that are perfectly great projects, but they don't have those giant, insane rates of return. In other words, you're going for the projects that are what we call the Hail Marys. Fine if you want to do that. It's not a good idea, though. Well, kind of yes, but they both start with the thing that you can't just pull something out of thin air and say this is an absolute that we should do. That's all I have for you. I thank you.